gentlemen. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is Red Ice Radio. RedIceCreations.com, RedIceRadio.net, and also RedIceMembers.com. That's our website where you can find much more of what we do. If you're new to the program, I can let you know that we do three radio shows each week. Additionally, we produce videos, TV, and insight episodes. We speak with guests, do analysis, and investigate both some of the symptoms, but also, of course, the cause of many of the problems that we find it to be vital to address and know more about. Specifically at this time, in order to understand why our world is the way it is, we seek to understand better those who are meddling in other people's business and lives. We look closer at many topics, but key is to understand the movements, groups, and ideologies that lie at the root of manipulation and subjugation, both of our history, but also who we are and our way of life. And we hope our discussions will help to arm you intellectually with inspiration and reason so that we can have a better idea of what we can do about it in order to preserve and improve ourselves. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We have a Facebook page, YouTube channel. We are also on Stitcher, and we also have a busy news section with frequent updates. Today our guest is Jared Taylor from American Renaissance. He has a Bachelor's of Arts in Philosophy from Yale University and a diploma from Institute of Political Studies in Paris. He was a former news editor at Washington Times, and he is the president of the New Century Foundation. He is the author of Paved with Good Intentions, A Race Against Time, and White Identity, Racial Consciousness for the 21st Century, to name a few. Jared's work, research, and views are, I think, a vital addition in the extremely one-sided debate. While I wouldn't call it a debate per se, I would call it unfounded name-calling, ad hominem attacks, and guilt by association when it comes to how the media are treating these issues, seeking to delegitimize the questions that Jared and many others highlight when it comes to race, race differences, biology, intelligence, the multicultural experiment, and the aspect that everyone except Europeans or whites are both allowed but also encouraged to organize, look after their own interests, and start advocacy and lobby groups. We'll speak more about why and other issues today. We have an interesting show ahead. Stay with us. Mr. Taylor, welcome. Great to speak with you today. Thank you for coming on the program with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You bet. American Renaissance has a conference here coming up in about a month, April 17th to the 19th, that I want to ask you a little bit more about later in the program. But I thought, as a way of kind of introducing you a bit more to our audience that might not be familiar with your work, maybe you could tell us when you started American Renaissance. Of course, you're also part of the New Century Foundation, and kind of what made you go into this very politically incorrect and consequently, I think, unpopular direction.
I started American Renaissance in 1990. That's back when it was a print publication. That's a long time ago. We had a monthly print publication up until about 3 years ago, and then we moved exclusively to Internet because it was such a much more efficient way to reach large numbers of people. I started it because clearly every other racial group in the United States, and in fact really around the world, has organizations and publications that promote their own interests, but whites do not. And this is ultimately a suicidal double standard that permits other groups to press for their own interests but forbids that kind of activity to whites. So mainly the purpose of American Renaissance is to encourage whites to realize that they do have a legitimate interest as a group, that they do have a distinctive heritage and a distinctive destiny that they have every right to pursue.
Now, let's talk a little bit more about the biology of race, or race realism, as some people call it, and try to get a little bit closer to the question of why people are so afraid of discussing race and facing the reality of this question.
That really is one of the, I think, most difficult questions of our time. Why is it, essentially, that whites have become so denatured, so demoralized in terms of their own biological kinship to a particular group? I don't really have a good answer to that. Surprisingly, whites are, in my experience, better prepared and more willing to say, well, yes, maybe North Asians do have a better mathematical spatial ability than whites, than they are to say something that is obviously much clearer and which there's a greater difference, namely that whites on average are more intelligent than blacks. They're more likely to say that, okay, Asians are smarter than we are, than to say that we are smarter than blacks. Whereas most of the time, people, if they are a member of a group, they seek for any excuse, any opportunity to describe themselves as superior to another group. And in fact, when whites are better able than blacks in many respects to do many kinds of abstract thought and organize societies, for whites nevertheless to say, oh, no, they're just as smart and hardworking as we are, why this kind of widespread demoralization has taken over, I really don't have a good answer to that.
Yeah, it is very curious. You know, I mean, race studies in the early days sure had some of the flaws. It's like any field, like physics or mathematics, some wrong, not all, but some wrong conclusions were made, but that doesn't mean, of course, that you throw out the entire field as we've done today. I mean, if we applied this to every subject, we'd have nothing left to study today.
The astonishing thing is that more and more whites have been persuaded to at least pretend to throw out the very concept of race. This to me is genuinely astonishing. You can look at a Bantu African and compare that person to somebody from Mongolia or from somebody from Denmark or a Mosquito Indian from Mexico. And there are obvious physical differences. But for whites to have let themselves be bamboozled and browbeaten into somehow thinking that this is some kind of sociological optical illusion, How does this happen?
Yeah.
It's a kind of mass hysteria that's very, very difficult to explain. Although, as I like to say, when it comes to the question of imagining that race is not a biological concept but a sociological concept, that's something that is so obviously wrong and so obviously stupid that only very intelligent people could persuade themselves that it's true.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so, you know, science, genetics, even Darwinism in this area is being thrown out, and scientists that are going in the direction is they're being shunned, they're pushed to the margins if they ever address this issue. It's very difficult to approach this subject then when this is what happens to some of the people who are addressing the issue, and there's no way of starting a proper debate on the issue anymore, you know?
Yes, it's an astonishing state of affairs. Although there is still a very active and intelligent group of scientists that continue to publish in specialized academic journals on the subject of racial differences in intelligence and the heritability of intelligence. It's just that their work never really breaks the surface and becomes part of mainstream consciousness. So this work continues to be carried on, but I'm looking for the day when a PTA member in a Kansas City school district can get up at a PTA meeting and say, well, come on, the reason there are so few blacks in the advanced placement courses is because they're simply, on average, not as intelligent as whites. And that settles the question, and we move on. When are we going to achieve that? It seems to be that almost obvious but ideal situation is glimmering further and further away into impossibility every year that goes by.
Yeah, I think someone said statistics or you know, these some of these findings, they say really nothing about the individual, but it says a lot about the group. And I think one of the problems here is, of course, that people take it as an individual insult for whatever reason, right? And this is the level where people take the statistics and the math on, right?
People certainly do seem to react as though it were some kind of vicious slur on an entire group of people to say that, well, on average, there's a difference of thus and such. And you're perfectly correct to point out that you can find individual blacks or individuals of any race who are extremely intelligent and smarter than a vast number of whites. But once you start looking at the collectivity of things, on averages, there are distinct racial differences, and these differences show themselves in world history over the last 1,000 or 2,000 years. Everything about the way the world works is in conformity with average differences in ability. And if you start denying that, then you are left with all kinds of complicated ad hoc explanations for why it is that wherever we find blacks in large numbers, they behave in particular ways. Wherever we find Asians in large numbers, they behave in particular ways. But if we are forbidden to draw on the obvious explanation, namely that they are biologically or genetically different, then we're left with all kinds of incoherence.
Yeah, indeed. Now, what if we would recognize that there are differences between different groups of people? Well, I mean, I was trying to figure what that would mean, because I think on the extremist end of things, some people surmise that, well, if we did that, some kind of supremacist group would arise that systematically would go about eradicating those that are deemed to be inferior or something like this. But this is, of course, a great exaggeration. But do you think that that's how some of your detractors argue?
You know, once in San Francisco, I met a liberal woman at a cocktail party, and we fell into this particular discussion. And I was presenting some of the arguments that suggest that there is a substantial difference in average IQ between blacks and whites. And to my astonishment, she ended the conversation by saying, well, that just can't be true, because if it were true, we'd just have to exterminate them all.
Well, really?
What? No, you could have knocked me down with a feather. First of all, that doesn't logically follow at all. And second, in the history of the United States, it was up until, perhaps about 1950s or 1960s, that it was taken for granted that on average blacks were less intelligent than whites. But that did not mean that people were out advocating genocide. In fact, all of the major changes in the status of blacks from freedom from slavery to the abolition of Jim Crow to the elimination of lynching and actual integration, all of these things took place in a larger context of the assumption that on average blacks were different from whites. So an understanding of the biological basis of differences certainly does not require any kind of supremacy or, heaven forbid, genocide. In fact, it can take place in a context of rather solicitously making sure that the status of blacks is improved step by step. So what follows from that notion, I think, is completely wrong.
So do you think that it would actually help race relations? I mean, I want to ask you about Europe a little bit later, but let's say race relations in America first.
Yes, I think an honest understanding of the fact that blacks and whites do not perform at the same level is essential to any kind of realistic accommodation between the races. After all, American society is constantly telling black people, you all are just as capable, just as smart and hardworking as those white people over there. The reason you do not succeed at the same level is because of all of those vicious racists who run this country. Teachers, policemen, legislators, newspaper editors, they're all out to get you. What kind of message is that to black people? And I think the consequence is we have established a system which is almost designed to make black people hate white people. If, after all, you're told over and over again that white people in the past enslaved you, white people in the past discriminated against you, lynched you, and even today, whites have this seething racism that explains why you don't succeed. I mean, for heaven's sake, what are they expected to think? They're supposed to think that we're wonderful people and live happily ever after? Absolutely not.
Right. Well, exactly. And then this, of course, is exacerbated by the media, as you say, people in authority. They speak out and say that it's systemic racism, etc. This is ultimately then leading to a kind of an unsolvable issue where we can't find any common ground. It's almost like they are seeking conflict to a certain extent.
That's right. We end up in a situation in which all differences are ultimately irresolvable, because any black advocate or any white liberal will say, look, we know that all the races are equal in ability, and yet we have these differences in achievement. Those differences can only be explained by white racism. So everything has to be explained in terms of white wickedness, whereas that's not what's happening at all. The very point of departure for the debate on race in the United States is based on a complete falsehood and a fallacy. And so the consequence is, as you say, we can never come to a realistic understanding and never come to any kind of accommodation between the races.
Yeah, I almost think it's kind of a divide and conquer tactic. At least in Europe, it's a little bit different there, of course. But I wanted to ask you, is it racism, according to, let's say, your detractors' definition of the term, to point out these differences and basically, you know, state what you've stated? Is that what racism is?
That is racism to a great many people, but as I like to point out, if you were to do a careful study of different racial groups and find that, for example, one race on average is taller than the other, you take your measurement tools and you reach this conclusion. Would that be a racist conclusion? If that's not a racist conclusion, why is it a racist conclusion to take the best measuring tools you have for intelligence and find out that here again, we have on average differences in that particular ability as well? It's when it comes to intelligence, that in particular, or any kind of personality trait, then yes, no matter how carefully you investigate the subject, no matter how firmly rooted in evidence and facts your conclusions are, to determine on the basis of these facts that there is a difference of some kind, that is simply immoral. The facts, your data, your experiments, your measuring tools, none of that matters. This is a forbidden conclusion, and anyone who is tempted by that conclusion has no human decency.
Now, one of the biggest issues that I have with this is the double standards that we see. And this is this issue that we are branded as, you know, either racists or supremacists when we kind of don't adopt a suicidal altruistic stance, I guess, for others, not for our own people, but altruism for others. But, you know, we're not good Europeans if we look out for our own interests as a group. And this is, of course, something that comes natural to any other group, ethnicity or race or what have you. But in this regard, if you would turn around some of the roles that we hear, and we hear the lingo in the media and how they talk about, you know, whites versus, you know, other people and what have you, then you discover pretty quick that it's a tremendous double standard. This is what I've noticed within, you know, Swedish society, for example, where it's perfectly fine to bash Swedes as them being the root of the problem and that we have these issues and whatever, but you can never look the other way there. And the double standards is one of the most monumental, you know, issues that I have a huge problem with, you know?
Yes, I agree 100%. And this double standard, as you say, is ultimately a suicidal one. To me, entirely aside from biological or any kind of genetically based racial differences, the desire to see one's own group prosper and to succeed, the natural sense of kinship that we have with people who are related to us in a larger sense, for whites only to be denied this feeling, for whites only to be told that their nations will be improved if people as unlike themselves as possible come in large numbers, and for many whites to be browbeaten into believing this. If we continue on this path, we whites, not only in the United States, but all around the world, wherever white people have established nations, our path is oblivion. No one takes this attitude towards the Japanese or the Chinese, for example, or the Nigerians. No one says to the Mexicans, look, you all need more diversity. You Mexicans, you need a bunch of Haitians in your country. You need Tierra del Fuegans. You need Vietnamese. All this will make you a much better country. No, no one ever says that to any non-white country. The idea, even, of suggesting that would be considered racism. If we were to say to the Mexicans, you need to be like us. You need ultimately to be reduced to a minority by immigrants of people unlike yourselves. That would be considered cultural imperialism. That would be considered neocolonialism. And yet, that is precisely what we advocate not only for ourselves in the United States, but for every other white country. As you say, this is a suicidal double standard.
Yeah, indeed. Now, history is being used against us at every stance, despite that we have a global history of warfare amongst practically every tribe, genocide, war over territory and resources. But for some curious reasons, it seems like Europeans are held to a different standard, and our history has been examined like, you know, nothing else. I mean, we had another professor with us from New Brunswick who wrote The Uniqueness of Western Civilization, very interesting book and very, you know, well laid out as well. The details, of course, some of the differences, and that there are a kind of a uniqueness there for sure. But when it comes to the, let's say, violence or the abuse or whatever, why do you think that Europeans are held to a different standard than other people?
I guess you're talking about Ricardo Duchesne.
That's right, exactly.
Yes, a fascinating fellow. I'd love to read his book. I'm ashamed to say I have not. But this issue of double standards in that respect, I think it's very closely allied to the double standard that means that whites are not allowed to protect the territories in which they are majorities. I think one of the reasons why we are considered more violent, for example, or more aggressive, is because we were the first who established the Industrial Revolution. And there was a period of history, maybe 300 years, 200 or 300 years, during which we were so technologically advanced compared to any other group that we could conquer any nation we chose if we set our minds to it. And in some cases, we did conquer these places. However, let us imagine the Japanese or the Chinese or the Nigerians, for example, equipped with the kind of technology that put them far ahead of anyone else, the kind that whites of that period had. I am absolutely confident that every one of those groups would have exercised that technological superiority in the same way we did, and perhaps, in fact, probably would have exercised it in a much more sanguinary way than we did. I think that whites, in fact, were remarkably restrained in terms of the way they put their remarkable technological advantages into practice. Just as an example, we are always told that during the Second World War or the First World War, the white people visited millions and millions of casualties upon the world and upon each other. Well, that's true. We had the technological means to do so, but don't forget that the Hutu and the Tutsi in Rwanda, Burundi, they managed to kill about a million of each other just with machetes.
Yeah.
Imagine what they would have accomplished if they'd had the Wehrmacht to work with.
Yeah, a gruesome thought to think about, but you're right.
Yes.
It's true. Well, exactly. And so do we have more to repent for? I mean, I always make the analogy that these are religious issues, really, to a certain extent. But again, we're back to the one-sidedness that you know, what we haven't brought anything good in the world then as well. I mean, this is ridiculous to think about this.
It's utterly, utterly ridiculous. But what is the most ridiculous is the number of whites who have swallowed this self-loathing. Now, that's, to me, the really curious phenomenon. As I said earlier, most groups take any excuse to consider themselves superior to others. In fact, there's a French proverb. It doesn't apply to white nations anymore, but the proverb says, every nation considers itself superior to its neighbors, and every nation is right. Well, not us anymore.
No.
Certainly not us. We could seem to consider ourselves inferiors. And again, this is a kind of self-loathing that is unique to whites. There is something about us that makes us particularly susceptible to this kind of willingness to march off the stage of history and let our destinies be taken over and put in the hands of others.
Yeah, some have called it ethno-masochism. I want to ask you a little bit more about that later. But how do you think that this was bred out of us then? Education, media, popular culture?
This question of why whites have lost something that seems so basic to human nature in all other groups, that's a very murky question. I think that the experience of the two world wars really was part of it. After the First World War, there was terrible demoralization among Europeans. They asked themselves, how could our culture, how could our this group, this destiny, this heritage we think of as being European, how could it lead to such a demoralizing massacre? And then the same thing repeated itself just a few years later in the Second World War. I think these were very demoralizing to whites. Another argument that people point to is Christianity, that Christianity is a universalist religion. It's not like some religions that seem to be more tribally oriented, and the idea that somehow if we were not good Christians unless we opened our nations up to others. I think there's something to that, but whites were Christians for 1,000 years without falling into that kind of terrible suicidal interpretation of the Bible. Some people say that there's been a decisive kind of Jewish influence on the thinking of whites. I think there's something to that as well, but that's not a satisfying explanation. None of these things, individually or in combination to me, come close to explaining something so unnatural as a group that is willing to subordinate itself. A majority group, not just in the United States, but Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Europe, wherever we are, all of us have been infected by this sickness that says, okay, take our countries, take our culture, take our women, take us away. That to me, it's without precedent in the history of the world, and I don't know of a satisfactory explanation.
Yeah, it's very strange, very interesting indeed. Now, let's talk for a moment about the historical view, I guess we could say, on multicultural states and nations. I want to ask if you know anything more about that, because I think you've talked quite a bit about origin of conflicts and how conflicts arise in various nations and whatnot. And right now we're, of course, part of a kind of an ongoing experiment. Sweden, for example, a perfect example of a political laboratory. It's a petri dish of it's an explosion waiting to happen, in my view, and we're seeing kind of the initial steps of that right now. But what do we know historically about multicultural states that try to achieve what we're trying to do today in the West?
I don't think any nation has really tried to achieve what we claim to be attempting to do. There have been multicultural empires, if you will. People suggest that the Austro-Hungarian Empire was an example of multiculturalism. And yet, in that empire, there was a largely homogeneous aspect to it. You had your Hungarians here, you had your South Slavs there, you had every group had its own area in which it was master of the language, master of the culture. You didn't have this attempt to mix things up. I don't believe that any nation prior to the United States in the 1960s, for example, and Europe increasingly now, has ever set out to establish a political entity in which race can be made not to matter. I think the very idea of that would have absolutely staggered anyone of the Western world up until about the 1950s or 60s. The very idea would have just seemed preposterous to them. Race obviously matters. The United States, as you no doubt know, the very first immigration law passed in 1790 by the very first Congress of the United States had to figure out something about the identity of the nation. And they said naturalization was to be limited to free white persons. They took it for granted that the United States was to be a white country. And we had an immigration policy designed to keep the country white until 1965. So all of this has been taken for granted. And then, in historical terms, all of a sudden, just in the space of a few decades, this notion has become widespread, not just in the United States, but all around the white world, that kind of thinking is illegitimate.
Yeah, indeed. Now, we hear all the time that diversity is a strength, but I'll say again, as an empirical example, we've seen how Sweden, for example, has gone in the last, I mean, we've had about 200 years, I'd say, of relative peace. It's been largely successful. We've built it up slowly to a country now that is plagued by huge economic problems, both social security, healthcare, and these kinds of things, education, but we've consequently had mass immigration, we've had crime and rape rates, sad to say, skyrocketing, massive household debt, etc. To me, it's an example. I've seen it in my lifetime, how it's transformed. My grandma has talked about this all the time, and I didn't believe her at the time, but as I've grown older, I see what she was saying. But That's contradiction right there. The diversity we've seen in Sweden is a strength, but we've seen the country completely plummet. I'm sure there's some other explanations here and there, but largely, I'd say it's a disaster.
Well, yes, Malmo is the famous place in Sweden of which I'm aware of, the Rosengård neighborhood. We have all of those immigrants who are creating areas in which the police and the firefighters dare not set foot. This sort of seething cauldron of refusal to assimilate, a contempt for Sweden and for Swedish culture, and this notion that that the local people, the women in particular, are simply there to be victims, raped. The curious thing about this is the refusal of the authorities and of the media to see clearly what is happening. It's just like in the United States and every other part of the white world, we keep repeating this false mantra of diversity as strength. I suppose we have to repeat that ever more loudly, ever more frequently, because it's so obviously false. We have to almost hypnotize ourselves to attempt to believe this, because all of the evidence of our senses shows us that when people try to create diverse societies of this kind, it's a failure and is not a strength and is only a source of tension.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think is the projection here then? People have said, you know, looked at Balkans as an example of what might happen in, like, we can talk about Europe for a little bit right now here maybe, and seeing that when we bring in, you know, massive amounts of Muslims and other people, other cultures, other religions, what have you, and there is kind of a demand, if you will, on them to kind of adopt that much to the host culture. There was for a while, but then they let go of that too. And now it's just basically the host culture becomes a culture which is there to accommodate everyone else and to a certain extent kind of keep the peace between these various groups that in some cases have been fighting with each other for hundreds of years. It's just so absurd, you know?
Yes. I don't know if you're familiar with the novel, I guess it's from the 1960s now, called The Ugly American. And the concept of the ugly American was the idea that Americans would go overseas and they would expect wherever they went to the people there to accommodate to their language, to their tastes, to their preferences. And this was considered a real ugliness. And yet, now, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well, when foreigners come here, we assume that it would be a burden to them to accommodate to our ways. We expect them to behave in ways that were characterized as ugliness, when Americans expected people overseas to accommodate to American ways. It's a complete flip-flop, so that what was criticized when we did it is glorified and taken for granted when others do it. As you say, these things are very, very difficult to accommodate. One of the aspects to me, though, that is particularly intriguing in the case of Sweden, and that is for France or England, people can criticize them and say, well, they are now paying the price of colonialism.
Yeah, right.
In the case of the United States, we can say, well, you're paying the price of slavery, of Jim Crow. We have these historical facts that can be hung around our necks. But for heaven's sake, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, There were never any non-white colonies. There was never any history of exploitation or maltreatment of non-whites. And yet those countries have fallen prey to the same kind of self-loathing as the countries that can be browbeaten about colonialism or slavery.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's because the aim here is to break up, white nations, European nations, and to cause the kind of situation that we see right now. I mean, to a certain extent, it could be naivety on the part of the politicians. They might have some pipe dream here of, creating some wonderful multicultural rainbow utopia or something. I'm not sure, but in some parts, I definitely think that partially globalism, partially some market forces, but also, of course, international communism and other issues kind of, they all kind of dovetail here, and there's some kind of agreement that this just needs to occur for the betterment of humanity or something like that. I'm not sure.
Well, but the odd thing is that this seems to be required to occur only in white countries.
Well, that's it. Exactly.
So, and some people will say that global capitalism is what brings this about. And yet, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Taiwanese, and increasingly the Chinese as well, are using global capitalism very much to their advantage in material terms without subverting their national or racial consciousness and cohesion.
Yeah.
So the system itself is not one that requires the sort of suicidal self-dissolution that's going on in the white world. And when you say the sense of inevitability, well, it just has to be that way. Borders are now increasingly porous. People are migrating. What can you do about it? Well, every other country but the white world is doing something about it. They are prepared to maintain themselves. So
yeah,
it's not a force of nature. It's a capitulation of the will.
Exactly. Of course, you have wars in Middle Eastern territories that are driving people off the land. But I was surprised to look at the numbers of how actually how few there were, percentage-wise, that actually was coming to Sweden, for example, as true refugees fleeing from war-like conditions. I think somewhere around 2-3%. Someone digged out that was about it, and so there's an awful lot of other countries that are trying to, and from Asian countries where conditions are fairly, you know, good over there too. So there's something else going on here, right?
Well, it's certainly the case that there are millions of Filipinos or Iranians or Iraqis or Algerians who would love to go live in Japan, for example. Japan doesn't accept refugees. Japan is a signatory to all of these same treaties as anyone else, but they have a tiny, tiny number of non-Japanese that they admit into the country. And no one is putting any tremendous pressure on them to do otherwise. The same is true for all relatively wealthy non-white countries. So when there's a refugee problem, it seems to me that the obvious thing to do is, if people really are forced to leave a country, then if they are to be accommodated someplace, they should be accommodated in some place that has a culture, a language, an ethnicity, a racial background similar to the country that they're leaving. But no, it's never that way. They're always being told, okay, you get to go to Sweden, you get to go to France, you get to go to Germany, the United States. This is just madness. Obviously, it would be easier for them to fit into some place that is more similar to their own background, and obviously it's much better for a receiving country to receive people that are more like the majority.
Right, exactly. Let me ask you something about the colonial past here, too, because I don't buy that if we look at France or England, Holland, Germany, etc. First of all, of course, how long are they going to, you know, to pay for this, and can we get, you know, kind of a number on you know, what this is about? But secondly, this then would also then be an admission to the fact that multiculturalism then is seen as a kind of punishment, wouldn't it?
Well, that's a good question. Whether it's a kind of punishment, I think the idea generally is that, take France, for example. France had an empire that included both North Africans and black Africans south of the Sahara. And at one time, the French did have this funny notion that all of the peoples of its empire were subjects of France. And theoretically, they could move to France if they wished. There was a kind of ambiguous state for some time there, because they weren't prepared to say France, the real France, is the white France, the European France. All the rest of you people, you are subordinate. They were not prepared to say that. And as a consequence of this, there was a certain amount of movement from the colonies. And then at the same time, well, actually later in time, there was this idea that after the Second World War, economies were booming in the 1960s, they needed labor, and these French-speaking people could come with the idea that they were going to be temporary. And then after the labor shortages ended, and these people were no longer necessary, France did not have the will to send them home, which is what the original idea was to be. There's something about the colonial contact that made it easier for non-whites to come, particularly to Britain and to France. And then once those people had arrived in large numbers, France and Britain lost the will to send them home. And I think that is a very important message, and it's important to the United States as well. Once a group of people is within your borders, it is very, very difficult for a Western nation to say, well, this was a mistake. We invited you here on a temporary basis, and we told you it was temporary to begin with, and now it's time to go home. White people seem to be incapable of doing this. And that's why, despite the fact that we have so many Mexicans and Central Americans living in the United States illegally, we are unable to say to them, you have broken the law, go home. We are going to legalize these people. I think this is, again, a suicidal step, and this is a whole separate question as to the fact that it's been taken in an unconstitutional manner by Barack Obama. But it is a lack of will on the part of whites, even while they are still a majority, to assert their rights as a sovereign majority.
Yeah, and despite that, of course, Mexico has lost the states that if there would be if the demographics would be upsetting in some capability, they would kick people out. They have very different immigration laws than America has. You know?
Oh, entirely different. The way I like to put it is if we were to imagine the immigration shoe on the other foot and illegal immigrants, white illegal immigrants, were pouring across the border into Mexico and demanding school instruction in English and voting papers in English and demanding amnesty despite the fact they'd broken the law and buying up radio stations and broadcasting in English, celebrating 4th of July rather than Cinco de Mayo, and coming in such large numbers that in a decade or two the Mexicans were going to be outnumbered. Could you possibly trick the Mexicans into thinking that this was cultural enrichment? No, you could not possibly fool them into committing suicide that way. And yet, that's precisely what's happening to us, and that's precisely the mentality we are supposed to have, that it is a wonderful blessing to be displaced by people unlike ourselves. That is again, back to the double standard that you mentioned earlier, a double standard that will consign us to oblivion if we fail to wake up to it.
Yeah, exactly. I want to ask you more later about the demographics and where this is heading projection-wise, but I want to wing by here as well. Isn't it strange, though, that to think that the majority population in a country is expected to be the administrators of their own country? I mean, if you have no concept of, let's say, ancestry or a cohesive, you know, or an allegiance, I guess you should say, to your people and have that type of consciousness, then maybe it seems ridiculous or what have you. But it's not strange that the majority of American corporations have Americans sitting in the boards and CEOs of those companies and running the political system. There's no communicating that, I guess, to people who don't think about it that way, right?
Well, I suppose what you're getting at here is this whole question of alleged white privilege. If you look around the United States and you see that the majority of the large companies are run and governed by whites, that's an example of some kind of unearned privilege. Well, that's just what you expect in a majority white nation. That would be the case in Nigeria, for example. Everything is run by the Nigerians, and one wouldn't expect it to be otherwise. To me, this whole question of white privilege is almost as absurd and as stupid as the idea of race being a social construct. Because let us imagine Iceland. Iceland is still overwhelmingly white, but it's got about a population of maybe 300,000. Well, imagine that 40,000 Somalis moved to Iceland. I think Iceland, without any non-whites, you cannot accuse it of having white privilege, but probably, I'm saying absolutely certainly, if 40,000 Somalis moved there, Somalis would end up in this high crime group, high poverty group. They would end up being not very welcome in certain neighborhoods, etc. And as a consequence, would the Icelandic people be better off? Would they suddenly be benefiting from white privilege because there were non-whites in their country?
Right.
It's absurd. Iceland would be vastly worse off were there to be a transformation of that kind. And likewise, in the United States, presumably whites benefit from the presence of non-whites because without non-whites, we have white privilege. And yet, if you think to yourself in any realistic way, if, say, every non-white in this country were to disappear, does that mean that the store detectives would suddenly start following white people around, expecting them to shoplift? No. The store detectives would simply be out of a job because they wouldn't be needed anymore. Would the police suddenly be keeping a sharp eye on white people because they thought they were going to commit crimes? No, we just wouldn't need as many police. But the idea somehow that we are benefited by the presence of non-whites, this is so utterly absurd, and yet it seems to be swallowed hook, line, and sinker by practically everyone who teaches a college course in the United States. Again, it's one of these astoundingly foolish things that only very complicated and smart people could convince themselves is true.
Yeah, it's always a good exercise to turn around and to see if you can discover any discrepancies or double standards there. I mean, it would be absurd to expect, as you said before, that if white people immigrated to, Europeans immigrated to Nigeria, for example, and then we expected to have more representation on the television and being part of, you know, politics of running the country and things like this. It's, no one would think that that would be reasonable, I think. But yet somehow it is in. See, the difference here, too, I've mentioned this before, but it's first of all, a lot of populations in Europe are already a global minority. They're very few, first of all. But then, of course, you do have the prospect of many other countries that people come from. They still have their countries, largely still homogenous. They're waiting. They could go back if something goes wrong or they don't like it or what have you. But in this case, there isn't a second Sweden. There isn't anywhere else where we can go to preserve our culture, you know, if things continue.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Whites are already a rather small minority of the world population. I think we're something like 12 or 13% of the world population, and we're having something like 6 or 7% of the world's babies. We are not even reproducing ourselves. This is precisely the sort of population which, if one were to consider in terms of conservation, would be a population that we would take special measures to try to preserve.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the United States, for example, has a very long list of endangered species, many of which I'm sure you've never heard of. One, for example, is called the Lashmar Cave Mold Beetle. Well, this little beetle that lives in just a few isolated caves in the United States, it's an endangered species. If you happen to have any on your property, you might not be able to develop your property because we care very much about the future of this mold beetle. Well, why is it that we're not allowed to be concerned about the future of white people? I think white people have certainly contributed more to the benefit of humanity than this mold beetle. But even to think in those terms, to think, no, I want white people, I want my kind to continue, I want my culture to flourish, simply to think in those terms is considered hate mongering.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely amazing.
Yes.
I don't know how else to put it, you know.
But I agree with your analysis. Very, very frequently, if you simply reverse the races involved, then you will realize just how absurd the situation is.
Yeah.
When blacks, for example, or Hispanics, they're always talking in terms of pride in their culture and pride in their growing numbers. That's fine. But if whites were to do it, that's no good. Or the transfers of population. People coming from the Islamic world, for example, into Europe, and insisting on building mosques with minarets and praying in the streets as they did in France. This is all fine. But can you imagine the outcry if white people were doing the opposite thing, moving into Muslim countries in large numbers, having church parades down the street? Oh, no, that would be cultural imperialism, absolutely out of the question. So it is, as you say, it's a very useful thing simply to put the shoe on the other foot and think of it in terms of what we consider fair and what we don't consider fair.
All right. Well, Mr. Taylor, we're going to take a break here in a little while and continue to talk more in the second hour. But before we do that, I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about the upcoming conference here in April in Tennessee. You know, please go ahead and mention some of the guests that will be coming, any other details you want to let our audience know about. And, of course, give us the website where people can go to find out more and what have you.
Yes, our next American Renaissance Conference will be held close to Nashville, Tennessee, April 17 through 19. That's over the weekend. And it's in a beautiful state park where we've held a conference several times before already. The season should be absolutely lovely at that time. And although we do our best to select the most interesting and engaging speakers, what people find particularly rewarding about an American Renaissance conference is the joy and stimulation of being around so many people who see the world the same way they do. I've never forgotten once a fellow who was showing up at his second or third American Renaissance conference. He came up to me and said, "It's great to be among the living again." Well, that's the way you feel. That's the way you feel at a conference of this kind. In your ordinary life, so many of us are just surrounded by zombies who don't see the world in any realistic way, who are completely fooled by the propaganda that makes them feel guilty about being white. But here you are with 200 people who all understand. There's something really thrilling about that. The kind of camaraderie and companionship and fellowship of a gathering like that is something that I think is very, very valuable. But our speakers this year, one will be Peter Brimelow. He is the presiding genius of VDare.com. I suspect many of your listeners are familiar with his webpage.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We will also have Ramsey Paul. I think he's really something pretty close to a genius in his ability to mix serious conversation with real thigh-slapping wit. I think that's an ability that very few people have. I wish I had it. When I start talking about serious questions, I get grim. You know, my fists begin to clench, and I think the survival of my race is at stake. It's hard for me to be lighthearted about it, but Ramsey Paul is a genius, sort of a humorist as well as someone who understands things clearly. Another of our speakers is going to be Richard Spencer, who's the head of the National Policy Institute. He's a very promising young fellow who has devoted himself to the matter of the survival of our race. I'm sure he'll give a great talk. Another of our speakers is named Matt Armstrong. He's been very closely involved in the national movement in Britain, and he has followed closely what happened to the British National Party, the BNP. So he will diagnose some of the errors that was made by that party and try to draw lessons for us in terms of how we might do things better. Another of our speakers is a fellow named Konstantins Pupurs. He is from Latvia. He is one of the founders of the All for Latvia party. And he will give a talk on nationalist politics in the Baltic Republics. And I think that he will give us an inspiring talk because so much of what's happening in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, is vastly more successful than anything that we find in the English-speaking world. In fact, when you think about it, the English-speaking world is really far behind in any kind of political representation of our ideas. So it's always good to see where these ideas are taking root actually in the political system itself. Another of our speakers is Sam Dixon. He is a lawyer originally from Atlanta who is, I think, one of the best speakers I know, no matter what the topic. I think he can give a better talk simply extemporaneously than most people can if they've had 6 months to prepare it. We will also have a session remembering Sam Francis. I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with Sam Francis, but he was a brilliant thinker about the racial question and the destiny of whites who died 10 years ago. He was a close friend of mine, and we'll be showing some videos of his and reminiscing about what a wonderful and talented man he was and what a loss it was to our movement when he died. And then something that is prompting a lot of excitement now, there will be a debate. Well, there will be two teams. One will be Richard Spencer and Sam Dixon, who I mentioned previously. And then on the other side will be Peter Brimelow along with John Derbyshire, who is another brilliant essayist who has a very firm grasp of the racial question. And the issue to be debated would be, can the political system solve the race problem? And I'm sure that will be a very, very lively debate. And then we will have a banquet, and we'll also have French participants who have rented a villa close to where the conference is. Well, it's within walking distance of the conference hall, and they will be hosting what is bound to be a wonderful party Saturday evening. It's very generous of them to be throwing this party, but again, as I said before, one of the great achievements, I think, of a conference of this kind is just the joy that people have in being in each other's company, of realizing that this is a movement that is not restricted to internet, to non-face-to-face contact, that these are real people with respectable positions, successful people who see the world as we do. It's always great to get together in that manner. Oh, and I suppose I should toot the American Renaissance horn a bit and explain how people should can register for the conference. That will be at amren.com, amren.com, and you will see the link to the conference in the upper right-hand corner of the page, and we hope that as many of your listeners as possible will plan on attending.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have the links up, of course, amren.com. And then, Jared, I also want to mention some of your books there. You have you can go ahead and mention White Identity, Paid with Good Intentions. There's another one I'm missing, I think, there.
Those are two books that I've written about the racial question. I wrote Paid with Good Intentions back in 1991, I believe, back when I was still considered somewhat respectable. And that book was published by a real mainstream publisher, Carolyn Graff. I think it holds up very, very well over time, and I have written several new introductions to it as it has been reissued. But my latest book is one called White Identity, and that goes into the whole question of our racial dilemma in a more no-holds-barred sort of way. And I think that many of your readers would find it interesting. I've also edited a number of books that are for sale on our site as well, one of which is called Face to Face with Race. And I'm particularly keen on this book. It doesn't contain anything written by me except for the introduction. But what it contains is direct first-person experiences by ordinary Americans of what it's like to come face-to-face with either blacks or Hispanics, and what that really means to be an American today in multiracial America. I think that when I write something about race, it's from a rather academic point of view. I like to read history. I like to read studies of race and IQ. I like to read sociological analyses. But I don't have the experience of being a white conductor on a New York City subway, for example. I don't have the experience of being in a skilled trade and watching it fall apart because affirmative action required the hiring of so many people. I've never been a public defender and had to defend so many black clients who were so unhelpful and hostile and uncooperative. These experiences bring, I think, a kind of gritty reality to American race relations in a way that all of my abstract historical or sociological or scientific analysis lacks. And so I'm very proud to have been able to put this volume together of essays, first-person essays of that kind. Face-to-Face with Race is what it's called.
All right, very good. Amren.com, go there to find out more and, of course, pick up copies of the books that Mr. Taylor mentioned as well. And, of course, don't forget to read more about the upcoming conference. I think you would enjoy to be at a place where you actually can discuss openly a very serious issue that is so suppressed and so shunned as it is in the mainstream. I've said for a long time that I think one of the biggest problems here is the very issue that we're not allowed to talk about these issues. And I think that that's actually something that exacerbates the problem and creates a whole lot of more problems than actually is necessary. So very important to be able to have this kind of dialogue. But stay with us, everyone. We'll take a short break right here, and then we'll be right back with more. We proceed with Jared Taylor in the second hour to talk about slavery, ethnomasochism, and white guilt. We'll move forward to get his take on what happened in Ferguson and why. We discuss how these problems are aggravated by the media and their role in fueling the fires. We speak further about the demographics change and the projections both for America and Europe, and why some people who say that they don't care about skin color actually are celebrating and rejoicing over the prospect of white people becoming a minority in America and in Europe. Towards the end, we ask Jared about where he sees this developing if we continue on the path we are on right now, and what that means, and what some of the consequences for this will be. We'll continue our discussion at redicemembers.com, our members' website. You can go there to sign up and tune in. We spare you from commercial interruptions and blinking website banners. And with a subscription, you get full access to our entire archives, all the second hours. And we have close to 1,000 programs now, so do take a look around in the archives. I'm sure you'll find some shows and videos that will interest you. We do, by the way, 3 new shows each week, and the first hour is always for free. Sometimes we make both hours for free. So if you like what we do and want to hear more, do take a look. It's only 5 euros per month, and we have subscriptions from 3 months, both recurring and non-recurring, up to 2 years non-recurring available. All the information is on the website. We have upcoming here on Friday, Radio 314 with Lana. She's going to speak with Joseph Carrick. On Red Ice Radio, we have Matt Forney, Rebecca Roth, E. Michael Jones, Marion Van Court, Joshua Blakeney, and Vasily Lupash, to name a few. But we'll be right back after this short break. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us for much more.